He told me a story this morning. I asked him if I could pass on to you. It's not about him, but it's a story that he heard when he was doing a men's seminar recently, another part of the country. He was invited by an organization to come and lead a group of about 60 men in a weekend. And the fellow who was the host of that seminar, where Brent spoke a month or thereabouts ago, told the story. And I want to begin our thoughts this afternoon by telling you this. It's a very simple story. Not a big, dramatic, heavy story, but it has a poignancy to it that I hope you'll catch, because maybe it'll set the tone for the afternoon. The man who introduced the seminar where Brent spoke told the story of his 5-year-old son who had just gotten himself a cowboy outfit. He had the double holsters and the cowboy hat. I can recall those days. How many guys in the room remember being excited about having your first cowboy outfit? Anybody here remember that? Isn't that something? How many women remember your first cowboy outfit? I had a Lone Ranger hat, cowboy hat, and I had a big, bright, shiny pistol. I remember that. And that was one of my biggest fights with Bill. Never forget, Bill got mad at me once and he hid my hat. Hid my hat, that's right. So I told Dad to hit him. This gentleman had a little boy who got all dressed up in his cowboy outfit and had his hat on and his six-shooters and his boots and whatever other cowboy shirt and pants perhaps that he had. And the father was in the garage, and the boy, little 5-year-old boy, went out the front door into the lawn, into the front yard, where his teenage sister was out in the front yard talking to two teenage boys who were would-be suitors. And if you can recall what it was like, gentlemen, you can recall this too, when you were trying to impress a teenage girl. Every guy in the world goes about it all wrong. And these guys went about it all wrong when the little boy came out dressed up in his cowboy outfit and walked out with a clear image, as the father told the story and Brent reported it to me, with a very clear image of, take a look at me. Aren't I neat? You know, I'm a cowboy. I got guns and hats and look at my boots and look at me. And you wouldn't call that pride, would you? You wouldn't rebuke the child for that. You'd enjoy the child. You'd respect the child. You'd say, yeah, let me see you draw, you know. You'd do that kind of thing, wouldn't you? I think you should. Of course you would. Well, these two boys, teenage boys, saw this little baby brother come out, 5-year-old kid dressed up in this cowboy outfit, that from a teenager's point of view is ridiculous. And to impress the girl, the older sister, they just began making snide remarks to the kid. Demeaned the little boy. And the father's watching the whole thing. He didn't know what to do. Fathers never know what to do. Oh, folks, that's not funny. They really don't. I'm a dad. I never know exactly what to do. For every 100 decisions I make, 95 aren't clear. There's a few that are clear, but 95 aren't. If you don't walk with the Spirit, you don't make it. The father didn't know what to do, but he just watched the scene transpire. This little boy came out with his 6 guns ready to have the teenage boys play with him in a respectful way of this neat kid with his guns on, and they just demeaned him and shamed him and made fun of him. And he watched that little boy and his head just kind of go down. And the little boy walked back inside the house, and the father followed him to the bedroom. And the boy, as he was in the bedroom, the father walked in, and the boy took off his hat and was unbuckling his holster, was taking off his boots. And the father said, what are you doing, son? The little boy, without looking up, said, I'll never be a cowboy again. What I want to suggest is that a whole lot of men feel like that. We're called upon to be warriors. Cowboys, maybe, is another metaphor. We're called upon to move into our world with strength, and for whatever reason, something's been lost by virtue of a decision. I'll never be a cowboy again, said a 5-year-old boy. I'll tell you a second story. Introduce the points I want to make this afternoon. I frankly forget who the story is about. I heard it firsthand, and I can't tell you who it was. It was either a client or a student. I heard the story about a month, 2 months ago. An adult, a man in his 30s, as I recall, I remember it was a man in some setting, mature man, told me the story that when he was about a 7 or 8-year-old boy, and he was in second grade, in a school years ago, obviously, this group of four or five boys, 7 or 8 years old, second graders, were all in the boys' room, in the bathroom, in this school. And they were rowdy. They were making noise. What do you do when your little boys make noise? Do you require them to not make noise? Is there anything about emerging masculinity that in its immature form is appropriately called rowdy? Do you stifle that? Do you quench that? How many of you have been squelched in being rowdy? Well, these handful of kids, 6, 7, 8-year-old boys, were in the bathroom, the boys' room, and they were making noise, and they were carrying on, and probably in a way that was a little more than they should have, and a school teacher walked by, a woman, and she heard the noise in the bathroom, the boys' room. Now, you're the school teacher, you're the woman. What do you do? Well, I'm not sure what you ought to do, but I know that this boy said that this school teacher woman did. She went into the boys' room and scolded the kids with great strength for making too much noise and to stop all that. And she was in a real bad mood, I guess, and these kids were acting up. I don't know how bad, but they were acting up, and they got roundly scolded. And the man that was telling the story, at the time that the woman teacher came in, he was standing by the urinal, urinating. And don't hear this as an attempt for any sort of humor. I don't mean it at all that way. But you know how little boys sometimes go to the bathroom when they stand at a little boy's urinal in the men's room. Oftentimes they don't unzip their zipper, they kind of pull everything down. Well, he had his pants and his underpants kind of pulled down a bit so he could go to the bathroom. And the teacher came in, and she grabbed all the kids and pulled them out, and she grabbed him with his pants down and pulled him out in the hallway. Something's been lost. I'll never be a cowboy again. Something's been damaged in a man's soul through a variety of experiences. All of us have gone through, every boy in this room has gone through some experience like that. What's been lost? What does God intend for me to live out as a man that's been lost? What does God intend to be growing in intactness that's been damaged by memories of being yanked out into the hallway where there were other kids and my pants were down? What's been lost? What's been damaged? As I talk about what it means to be a man this afternoon, talk about masculinity, let me say two things that are very preamble, then get into the things I want to say for the rest of the afternoon. First thing I want to say is that there's a lot of women sitting in the room. And let me tell you what I hope you'll get out of this. I'm not going to be talking about womanhood today or about the essence of femininity. I don't feel terribly qualified to discuss that in great detail. But what I'm hoping is that as you hear me talk about manhood, that whether married or single, that you'll develop perhaps maybe a little richer appreciation for what's required, what God asks of men. And you'll learn something of the uniqueness that is within you as a wife or as a friend. A wife has certain opportunities, a woman friend does not, but both wives and friends, women with men, have something very powerful within them that when given to a man can be a profound encouragement in the development of their masculinity. And I hope as you gain, hopefully, maybe a little richer appreciation of the challenges of masculinity, I hope that your minds will not be going to, well, we got our own challenges, you know. And of course you do. And that would be a legitimate 3-hour seminar this afternoon. I just wouldn't know how to teach it. I'm not questioning that for a second. But I hope that just for the moments at least, you can get your minds off the fact that you've got your own set of real struggles and femininity. And you know what it's like to have events when you were a little girl. And maybe you didn't put on your cowboy outfit, but maybe you put on your pretty new dress and got laughed at or ignored or something. You have your own challenges, but for the moment, put your minds on what God has called men to, and see how you can use your incredibly powerful resources to be an encouragement to your husbands, to your boys, to your sons, to your friends, to your fathers, to men in general. The second thing I want to say is maybe a little more of a commercial thing. Forgive me for this. I have developed about a 10-hour seminar on the topic of masculinity. You're getting just the kind of a condensed version of it here in a 2-hour workshop. And I gave it for the first time in its present form in Charlotte a month or thereabouts ago. And I'll be giving it in Kansas City with a group of folks, some of whom are here with us this weekend. Mike and Jamie are somewhere around, and they're from Kansas City, and I'll be speaking at their group of churches in Kansas City. If that's of any interest to you, that's going to be sometime in February. There's a sheet out in the foyer that if you want to sign up, you'll be given the brochures. And I'll also be doing it in New York City sometime in March. I don't have my dates with me, but if that's of interest to you, to hear a Friday night and all day Saturday seminar in Kansas City or in New York, there are sign-up sheets. Just to receive information is all that the sign-up sheets are for. And that's a Friday night and all-day Saturday seminar. What's been damaged? What's missing? My guess is that if we look at the data honestly, we'd all agree that something's wrong. Something's missing. Something's been damaged. You know that something's missing, something's been damaged, because you look around and you know something's wrong. And you know something's wrong if you talk meaningfully to men and let them tell you their story honestly. And you'll hear stories like these that let you know something's not right. There was a man at our advanced seminar last April, a pastor, who told me after this men's seminar at 3:30, he grabbed me and we spent a few minutes together as he was in tears telling me that he realized that every day when he comes home from the church, from his ministry, from his work, and he walks in the door, he said, "I've never seen it quite this way before, but I walk in the door and I'll do anything to avoid movement toward my wife when I first get home at night. I make a point to get the mail. I'll go up and give her a peck on the cheek. Hi, honey, how's your day?" And then kind of be busy with the envelopes and opening up the bills and the letters and grab the newspaper or check the 5:30 news or do something. And he said, it's never occurred to me before that I'm terrified of that woman. I'm terrified to engage deeply because I know after a hard day at the office, after a day of pastoring and having people let you know that you've disappointed them, having people let you know that you haven't come through for them the way a good pastor would, something inside has felt very demeaned, has felt very shaky, very fragile, and you walk in the door and you're terrified that if you walk up to your wife and say, "Honey, it's really good to see you. And I love you, and here's a hug, and here's a kiss, and listen to that, and let me tell you about my day, and let me hear about yours." I'm terrified if I come in and talk like that and move toward you, that my wife's response, he said to me in tears after the seminar, my wife's response would be something other than meaningful response. And I'm just not sure if I can handle that. The most important men who are married, do you know what it's like to walk into your home and to feel ugly? But you hide it. Because you know you are ugly. You've done something really crummy. You've not been nice to your wife that morning when you left for work, and you walk in the door and you really feel ugly. And so what do? Well, you get the mail, read the paper, make a phone call. Something's wrong. Talked to a man a little while ago, a single man who has a very, very hard time moving toward women. And he's dated quite a bit, but he simply has never popped the question. And he's hidden behind the sentence, which can be a true sentence for many. Please don't overhear me. But this man is hidden behind the sentence, "I've never found the right girl." That can be an accurate sentence, but I believe he's hidden behind it. As we talked for 3 hours about 2 months ago, he said to me this, that if I ever move into a woman's life, that's very masculine language. If I ever move into a woman's life, I'm afraid, his quote, "I wouldn't have the right stuff." Once fully there, would there be anything that a woman would respond to when I stand there naked and erect? Moving strong with a woman in her life. By the way, one of the points you're going to hear me say is that I believe God designed our bodies as a picture of our souls. And I believe that the way he designed our male and female bodies is a parable of the shape of our souls. Now, I understand the soul has no literal shape, it's a metaphor. But I'm going to suggest that a man is called upon to strongly enter and pour something forth. A woman is called upon to warmly receive and surround with nourishment. Those are sexual metaphors. I'm talking about the soul. Another evidence that something's wrong with men. I was in another city a little while ago, maybe it's a year by now, I suppose, and a fellow there told me that he had just broken his engagement with a woman, and I asked him to tell me his story. Counseling is storytelling. That'll be our theme for tonight. And I asked him to tell me his story. In the course of the story, he said this. He said, "Well, we were going along real well and been engaged for about 6-7 months, and the wedding was scheduled for another 4 months later, and everything went fine until one day, as we were chatting one evening and getting into a very intimate, heavy conversation, she made known to me that she had a history of sexual abuse. And something inside of me just clenched. I felt terrified. Gentlemen, what do you feel when your wife makes known a problem for which you haven't got a clue how to respond? What do you feel when something happens inside of your wife, something's going on, and you just don't know what to do, and you're terrified out of your mind? Are you thrilled to be a man? Or are you terrified to be masculine? Something's wrong. What's going on? What do you suppose is, What do you suppose is missing and been damaged that leads to this terrible thing that's wrong with men today? Some of you single women are praying like mad, aren't you? Because the pickings are pretty slim, is what a lot of you feel. The good ones are taken. But a lot of you single women have talked to me over the years, and what you've said to me, those who have not been called to singleness, those who are very open and believe God would like them to be married, and as you date, you find that men don't move. What's wrong? I was involved in a men's group a year ago in which I developed the idea that there's something about the masculine soul that at core is by design very aggressive. At core, by design, there's something about the male soul that is not true of the female soul that is by design very aggressive. And that aggression, which usually is a bad word in our vocabularies, and I'd like to reclaim it as a good word if we can, that aggression has taken a bad form, which has given the word a bad name. In the course of this meeting with a group of guys about a year or thereabouts ago, I said, let me see if you guys feel the same kind of aggressive fantasies that I feel. What kind of fantasies do men have? I'm not speaking just of sexual fantasies, that's another story in itself, but what kind of other fantasies do men have? You know one of the urges that I find arising within me? If we began talking about the urges that are arising within us and began getting very honest about that, we'd all would really pray for glorification very, very quickly. Because every one of us here is weird. It's so nice to know you're all weird, so when I talk about my weirdness, I know I'm in good company. Anyone who thinks you're not weird, you're just pretending. One of my weirdnesses that I told the men's group about when I said, you guys feel aggressive in your fantasy, and a lot of the guys kind of look at me kind of, you know, I don't know, aggressive, what do you mean like? And I said, well, let me give you an illustration. There are times that I'm walking down a flight of steps, flight of stairs, by somebody ahead of me. And the thought occurs to me, wouldn't it be fun to kind of move a little faster to get behind them, and just to go, okay. And I'll visualize this sometimes. And in my visualization, I'll watch the person kind of tumble down, and I'll feel very alive and proud. I caused that. What's that a perversion of? It's a perversion of something good. Now, the perversion is obviously bad, violent, wrong, wicked, but it's a perversion of something good. And I told these guys that story, and the response was, oh, is that what you mean? Yeah, I know, I understand that. And one of the guys said, yeah, one of my favorite fantasies, when I'm in a bad mood and my boss has chewed me out or when something's going wrong with my wife, one of the things I love to visualize is getting in my car and somehow arranging to strap a big metal I-beam on my front bumper and go into traffic. Just drive around, you know. Wesley and Stephanie Coker, the couple that had to go home because her dad is dying, and told me the story. And told me I could tell you this. I anticipated this Monday night, I think. That Wes and Stephanie were at that seminar where I made that same those same comments about an I-beam and pushing people downstairs. And they were driving back from the seminar Sunday morning. And Stephanie was riding the car, the rental car. They're going back to the airport to fly home. And Wes was driving. And Stephanie was saying, do you guys really think about things like pushing people downstairs and I-beams? And I mean, is that what men really think about? And Wes said, yeah, didn't you know that? Man, when I think about that, something inside just goes, wow, you know, getting my cowboy boots out and my pistols and ding, 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 you know. And he said, as he was driving along, and Stephanie was saying, really? I mean, this is not what I think of. When I have my bad mood, my fantasy is not I-beams on cars. And Wes says, well, it is for me. Man, it's just, you don't understand, Stephanie. This gets me so alive. And he's driving along, and he's saying, yeah, I mean, even the power behind the wheel is just terrific. And he's driving along, and all of a sudden, the blue lights, and he was pulled over. The cop gave him a ticket. Is that great? That story will last about 4 or 5 seminars, I think. There's something just very aggressive about masculinity. But I-beams and driving fast and pushing people downstairs, they're all a perversion. And as Dan talked about in his addictions lecture, rather than trying to smother their urges that are wrong, maybe trace them to their roots and see that beneath the corrupted surface, there is a root that's good, that needs not to be smothered, but rather released. And when legitimate passions are released, corrupted passions become less attractive. There's a principle there. When legitimate passions are released, corrupted passions become less attractive. Working with a couple that last Christmas time a year ago now, there was the first Christmas without any of their children. And what this man did in a very angry depression, he went to the video store, rented 10 XXX videos, and spent most of the Christmas vacation watching them over and over again. And as he told me that, and I just internally and externally too, I kind of went nuts. I mean, that's awful. And he tried to make his wife watch the videos with him to spark up their dull sex life. And, I mean, that's just ungodly. We all agree you should have no business watching that kind of filth. But what do? Do you just say, take those videos back and don't buy them again? Of course you say that. There's room for exhortation, room for admonition, room for discipline. There's room for dealing with the behavioral sin. But what you say is that this counterfeit of wanting just to watch all these movies, that's kind of like the I-beam in worse form, wanting to watch all these movies, that's a perversion of something very, very strong within. And my sense to him was, you'll never get over your addiction to pornography until you learn how to be a man with your woman. But what does that mean? To be a man in life generally, if you're married with your woman, with women generally, with men generally, what does it mean to be a man? As I begin trying to think through what it means to be a man, and I suggest to you as a beginning thought that whatever manhood is in its essence reflects a masculine shape of the soul that parallels the masculine shape of the body. If that's at all a valid thought, then it's not too far to begin loosely by coming up with some understanding of masculinity along these lines. Masculinity has something to do with movement into. Aggressive, strong movement into. Another way of putting it, maybe a little more elegantly, is carrying life forward. The transmitter of life. Not the nourisher of life, but the transmitter of life. Carrying life forward with courage and imagination. All those words will make sense to you by the time we quit today. At least what I mean by them. Carrying life forward with courage and imagination. The courage of a warrior. The courage of a warrior who's willing to do battle, who sees that there is an enemy, and it's his job to jump on his horse, grab his sword, and to move into the situation, and to say, there is tension between you and me, honey, and the enemy here is not you, the enemy is sin, perhaps me, and I'm going to aggressively move into it. Who moves toward whom when you as a couple try to make up? Who often goes first? More often than not, it's the woman. That's a violation of masculinity, gentlemen. I'm not saying it's wrong for a woman to go first. I'm saying that if that's the pattern, because the man refuses to, that's a mistake. That's your fault, gentlemen. What does it mean as a warrior to carry life forward and to say there's a violation of life right now, there's a difficulty right now, and I want to deal with it? Yeah, I'm scared to death. I don't know what to do, but I'm going to deal with this thing because I've been called upon to move into life with strength and to pour something out of me that has the potential for, if it meets the egg at the right time, conception can occur.
Because I'm fertile. Every man in the room and his soul is fertile. Some bodies aren't. But every man's soul is fertile when released by the Spirit. Fertile to do what? To carry life forward with the courage of a warrior and the imagination of a poet. Why do I talk about a poet? Very simply, because the Bible is not a cookbook. The Bible does not give specific directions. When you and your wife are having a quarrel, here's exactly what to do. The Bible doesn't say that. How frustrated have you been when you've had a tension with your wife and you go to the Scriptures for help and all you find are verses like, love your wife as Christ loved the church. What does that mean in this situation? It requires the imagination of a poet to move forward. You've got to think. You've got to think you've got to think with creativity. Maybe it's as simple as buying flowers. Maybe it's as simple as moving toward her in a way that you haven't for a long time. Why, when Rachel and I, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, were having some points of real tension, we hardly ever have, you understand, points of real tension, but 2 or 3 weeks ago, she made a mistake, and, you know, and I gallantly handled it. Now, I had been a real bum, and there were some points of tension, and she was feeling very left out, and there are times that she feels very left out, because I leave her out. She told me just a while ago that when she hears me, one of the things I often teach in Malachi, where it says your wife is your covenant by companion, or your companion by covenant. You've made a covenant of companionship, and as long as you're alive, your pledge is that your wife never be lonely. And Rachel said, I sometimes hate to hear you teach that because I'm lonely a lot. And I don't know how to work life well enough to move toward her to keep her from ever being lonely. She's been lonely this week a fair amount. He told me, just mentioned today, that we haven't eaten a meal together all week. I think that's my fault. I could say no to you. Why have I said yes all the time? As you move toward a situation, move into life with poetry, you're not quite sure what to do because there's not specific directions. You're not exactly sure what to do at any given moment. And I told my wife a couple of weeks ago, when you're having a point of tension, I didn't tell her, I thought this through, I would like to move toward her, but the verse in Ephesians 5 doesn't tell me how to do it, it tells me to do it, it gives me a broad framework, but then poetry is required to make it work, and I had to think in terms of my situation, and what I did was I got home around 4 o'clock, and she was out, wasn't going to get back till 5, she was speaking somewhere, and I left a note for her, thinking she might come in before I returned from my errand, and I said, well, don't cook dinner tonight, and I went out, and I don't cook, so I bought and went home an Italian meal and went to the movie store and got a good old dime classic movie. And we spent the evening watching the movie after having the dinner that I provided. The evening wasn't all that it should have been because during the movie I fell asleep. The dilemma of existence is nothing quite works the way it's supposed to. But I want to argue, if you hear my meaning, that that's the responsibility of a husband, to be poetic. You got to think. Ladies, what is it true that you hate hearing from your husband as much as anything else? Well, what do you want me to do? Why? What you're saying to him is, be a poet. You figure it out. Where do you want to go for dinner? I'll take any place you want. What movie do you want to see, huh? Oh, I don't care. Well, I'm going to stay home. And, you know. You women are enjoying this, aren't you? What's behind all this? Something's been lost. I'll never be a cowboy again. Something's been damaged. You pulled me out into the hallway with my pants down. And as a result, something's wrong that makes me say, well, where do you want to go? What most men do is never deal with what's wrong. Never face what's lost. Never embrace what's been damaged. Because it's terrifying to our souls. We find some way to adjust without ever facing all this stuff. You don't want to face all this, for goodness sakes. That's just a pain, you know. Yeah, I'm doing fine. Hey, I got a good job. What's the big deal? We paid the bills and got a new car last year, and we're going away for Christmas. You know, what are you griping about? Come on. We never deal with the real issues of our lives. Real men don't deal with real issues. And as a result, we become a slave to certain passions. Let me tell you, we're just kind of rambling together this afternoon, so let me just kind of loosely discuss, just making suggestions, not giving you definitive teaching, just some thoughts. Let me tell you that men who don't have the courage to deal with what's really wrong end up becoming a slave to three central passions. Men who haven't got the courage to deal with what's really wrong, facing what's lost, grieving over the cowboy boots that are hidden in the back of the closet and never pulling them out and putting them on. Men who never enter the reality of the damage and never allow themselves to feel what they felt when the teacher pulled them out in the hallway with their pants down. Men who never enter into the reality of their struggles, and most men don't, simply because when you do, it doesn't work real well. You just get more messed up for a long time. There's no way to fix this thing quick. So you start facing all this, and you just be a mess for a while. So don't do that. You know, just get on with your life. For goodness sakes, what's all this psychology stuff? I'm going to be biblical. We'll have devotions tonight. We'll handle it. So rather than dealing with all this, they become slaves to certain passions. The primary passion of a man, I would suggest, I mentioned this a night or two ago, the primary passion of a man that's a counterfeit of what God designed him to do is a passion that can be stated this way: I must do something well. Every individual with the energy of Cain builds a bridge. Every individual with the energy of Cain, as they build their city, change metaphor now, they build a bridge. And the bridge is meant to carry the traffic of life. Whatever weight comes along, when you hear bad news that your daughter ran away, when you hear bad news that you're on drugs, when you hear bad news you've lost your job, when you hear bad news that the promotion you're getting isn't going to come through, when you hear bad news that your attempt to teach Sunday school class has been turned down because you weren't a very good teacher, you want to find some bridge to handle all the disappointments of life. What's your bridge that you built? Most men find something that they can do well. I must do something well. Maybe it's make money, and you buy a fancy car, and every time you get in it, something inside of you comes alive, and you feel more alive getting in your brand new car than you feel in a bedroom with your wife. A whole lot of men have very little sexual interest in their wives, and they feel better in their new car than in the bedroom with their attractive wife. I must do something well. I need to leave a mark. When I was in college, my favorite professor was Dr. Mattern. In the basic seminar, I tell a story about Dr. Mattern in the Job devotional. Some of you might recall that. During my years at Ursinus College in the Philadelphia area, Dr. Mattern died when I was a senior. I'd had him for a number of classes. He had meant a great deal to me. He was an unbeliever, but he left his mark in my life. There was a time that he had called me into his office for something or other, and I forget what it was. But I wasn't prepared for whatever assignment I had to do, and I didn't go to his office, but it wasn't because I wasn't prepared. I got sick that day. And Mattern was profoundly disappointed in me because he interpreted my not coming to his office as having wimped out. And the next time I saw him, he was looking at me with great displeasure, and I said, Dr. Mattern, what's the problem? And he said, you didn't come yesterday. I believe you're a coward. Dr. Mattern, I was sick. And I'll never forget his response. He was, you were? And I said, yeah. And he said, I am so glad. He said, I didn't think you were a coward. I was so disappointed to see you behave like a coward. And now that I realize you weren't, I'm just so thrilled. And inside, man, I'm going, this is good. This is good. He died. I went to his funeral. Half the student body turned out. He was a very popular professor. The chaplain of our school was not a Christian, not a believer. A pagan liberal got up front and did the funeral service of this unbeliever who died and went to hell. And he said this: the great turnout today to honor the passing of our beloved Professor Dr. Mattern testifies to the mark that he left in each of our lives. And I'm sitting there thinking of, yes, this man left a mark in mine. And then he said, it is fitting that we come today to honor the memory of this man who made the mark, because soon the mark will be no longer remembered. And his life, we must visualize, all of our lives, like Dr. Mattern's, we must visualize as a man walking on the shores of time, leaving his footprints in the sand, and we are here to gaze and remember the footprints until the next tide comes in and washes them away forever. And I remember sitting there wanting to scream. Why? And I said to myself, whoever does my funeral, they'd better do a better job than that. That's pathetic. I want to do something well that leaves a mark. Deeply leaves a mark. Something that I can say, I've done it. It's me. Look at my six guns. Watch. Do I draw them quick? What do you think, teenage boys? I want to do something well. Life presents so many opportunities to fail. Y'all notice that? Marriage ups the odds. Presents unique opportunities to fail. And fail we do. I want to do something well. And the place where I know least how to do something well, it sometimes seems, is in my marriage. Some of you heard me tell the story of almost a year ago, Rachel and I were at Moody Bible Institute for a Moody Founders Week. We were up in a hotel room, and it was time to go down to meet some folks and to go to the next meeting, and we were supposed to leave the hotel room at 5:30. It was about 5:29, moving toward 5:30, and I was ready. And I was sitting in the chair in the little hotel room we had there, and had my tie and coat on, six shooters in place. And Rachel wasn't quite ready yet. And she was standing in front of the mirror, looking in the, not in the bathroom, but in the bedroom, and there was a mirror there above the dresser, and she was looking, doing the final things that women do for 30, 40 minutes. And she said words that every man dreads. Y'all know what they are? For candidate, we would win. There are many options that fit that description. The words she said to me that aroused dread within my soul were these as she looked in the mirror. She said, oh, my hair doesn't look good. What are you supposed to say? You want to do something well? Then forget your marriage. You want to do something well? What do you say at that point? You've all been there, haven't you? You've been there this week, how many times? You know? Your wife says, my hair doesn't look good. This doesn't look right at all. What do you say? Well, you thought about, you know, you've been married for a while, and I think of the different times you tried different ways. And you think of something like, you know, saying to her, gee, honey, I think it looks great. And you tried that before, and you know what happens. I mean, what does your wife do when you say, gee, honey, I think it looks great? Does she say, oh, that really helps. Oh, what a guy, you know. Why didn't she do that? Doesn't it bum you with tears that you say, I think it looks great, and she goes, it's going to look terrible, you know? And then you walk out in the hallway, and there's some other woman who says, hey, your hair looks nice. She says, oh, really? And you're just, I'm going to go back to work. I know how to fix teeth. I know how to be a lawyer. I know how to do this. So I'm sitting there thinking, well, if I say to her it looks good, it's not going to work. So what do you say? Oh, my hair looks bad. So what are you saying? You think, well, maybe you say something like, you got a point. That isn't a whole lot better. So I don't know what to say. So I'm a creative, poetic, warrior genius, and I write books on this stuff. I know what to do. So I said, looks good from the back. Figured she couldn't see the back, so maybe she might believe me. You know. To which she responded, oh, I'll walk backwards all day then. I really want to do something well. and I'm a whole lot better teacher than I am husband. I lead seminars a whole lot better than I father, or husband, or friend, or love. Why do most men devote themselves to whatever they're good? Maybe it's playing cards with the guys every Tuesday, and they're good at small talk. Maybe it's meeting Sunday afternoon to watch the ball game because they know all the players. I must do something well. You find some bridge that handles the weight of life, and when the weight gets hard, you run to your bridge and watch more football, get more pornography, add 5 more hours to your weekly schedule, buy another new car. You do something because you got to do something well. That's a passion. That's a perversion of something legitimate. Second passion grows out of the first. The first one is primary. Second passion is, I must protect something fragile. I must protect something fragile. Not a man in the room that doesn't feel there's something inside of him that's very fragile. Not a man in the room doesn't feel there's something inside of him that's very, very fragile. A lot of men don't look fragile. A lot of guys that are, 6'2", 210, that kind of thing. Fragile? Well, you got to be kidding. Yeah, men are fragile. Men avoid those situations where their resources will not be adequate. I did a Bible study last year for an NFL football team, pro team. Rachel and I were sitting there with 5-6 couples, all pro football players. One guy, the biggest name in the room, star, sitting with his wife. He's a big guy. He knocks people over for a living every Sunday afternoon. His wife is about 5'2", maybe 110. Cute little blonde thing. He's terrified of her. In the course of the conversation, I made a comment to her. I said, as I noticed as we were conversing in our Bible study, kind of leading a discussion thing, I noticed that when she would say certain things, he would just kind of back off. There was no energetic movement into the discussion. He would kind of back away as she talked. And so I picked up on that and I said to her, When does your husband seem to want to back away from you? Does he ever kind of just got a game plan Sunday afternoon? You're okay when nothing's at risk because you know the game plan, you know you have it. But when there's no game plan for how to handle something, you back off. I said, sir, you're not very manly. And I left the room very quickly. I'm courageous, but I'm not stupid. We don't like to move into a situation where whatever we have that we're holding on to might be exposed for what we know it really is, not enough. We preserve something fragile. Rachel was away speaking somewhere, and she called me from where she was. She was about an hour drive away from home, and she had had a wonderful weekend of ministry. She was leading a women's retreat. And she called me on a Sunday afternoon about 2 o'clock. She was about to leave for home, and she said, I just want to call you before I left. I'll be home in about an hour or so, but I wanted to tell you it was a great weekend. I said, well, great, tell me about it. And when I said tell me about it, I meant maybe a sentence. And she began telling me about it. And the Spirit of God really had given her just a wonderful weekend and some wonderful things had happened. And she began going on with great excitement about how wonderful the weekend had been and how grateful she was to God. And she was having a great time telling about this weekend. And I'm sitting there realizing that she had called collect. And in only an hour she could be home and tell me for free. And so I said to her, in the middle of her excited conversation about the things that were happening, I said to her, well, honey, why don't you just come on home and tell me all about it then. We'll sit together and I'll listen to it all. Right away, you could hear the enthusiasm just die. And she said, oh, well, okay, I'll see you in an hour. Well, I picked up on something that was wrong. I'm trained. An hour later, I hear the garage door go up. And figured it was Rachel. Now, I don't normally always go to the garage when I hear the garage door go up. And the fact that she'd been away for a weekend might justify my going, of course, but I think I went to that day to the garage for a very different reason. I don't like the tension between us, and I want to go make sure that she's not still mad. How's that for courageous warrior-like stuff? She's out of the car. Hi, honey, how you doing? Big hug and a kiss. You ever kiss somebody on the lips, and even though the lips are pressed against yours, they're not kissing? It is possible to be in the movement, but there's nothing happening somehow. You know? And I knew that. And I did what any normal man would do. I just left it at that. I got a bag, went inside, and went back to the football game. Why? I don't know how to handle that. I want to preserve something fragile. If I move into that situation and she attacks me and points out where I failed and I'm going to start feeling like something's awfully wrong with me and what little intactness I have left is going to go. I don't want to face that. I'll just go back to, I'll watch the Broncos and watch them lose again. Wait for the Bulls to be on that night. Later that night, I did talk to her, and I said something was really wrong, and it took a long time, because there's times my wife's afraid of me, because when she's made herself known, I've sometimes hurt her very badly. And she said, I just don't feel like I have much of you. I feel like that what really matters to me, you're not into. You're into your own thing. I call it my ministry. It might be called adultery. With equal accuracy. We preserve something fragile. That's second basic passion. Third basic passion. We work very hard to get something deserved. We work very hard to get something deserved. Follow my three-part thought here. We work to do something well to leave a mark. But we're not sure that we're doing a very good job of it, so what little we have left, we don't want to expose to humiliation and failure, so we protect something fragile. We avoid shame. And as we work very hard to do all this, how do we feel as we work hard in our lives? We feel the way Ken felt in the first tape, go back in your minds. We feel the way Ken felt on Tuesday morning in that particular tape. I've worked really hard, and somebody jolly well ought to notice. Do you know the struggles going on inside of me? Do you know how I don't feel like I do very much well at all? Yes, I'm a rich attorney and I just bought a new Mercedes, but something is still empty inside and I feel very fragile. And there's certain cases, and you don't understand this, wife, but there are certain cases I'm called to deal with that I don't feel all that competent. I feel insecure a lot of the times, and I actually turned down a case today where I'm not sure if I can handle it, and I went to other cases where I'm more competent, and I'm working all the time to preserve something fragile. I think it's about time I got my turn. I need to get something, and it's deserved. Darn it. It's deserved. I'm going to find relief. Woman, you want to give it to me? And when she doesn't, the centerfold will. The chocolate cake will. I'm going to find something, because I deserve it. Folks, you know the root. Root sin is not self-centeredness. It's justified self-centeredness. Nothing matters more right now than me. Nothing matters more than me. You knew what I've been through. You knew how I struggle. You give me a turn. Three passions of a man that do something well to leave a mark. To preserve something fragile, to avoid shame, to get something deserved, to find relief. Rachel and I were in Cambridge. Again, that's the story I tell at the basic seminar, so you may have heard it. Bear with it if you have. How many years ago? 2.5 years ago, I suppose, sometime. We were in Cambridge, England for a 3-month sabbatical where I wrote the book Men and Women and Join the Difference. And I had my little study there. We had a 2-bedroom flat, and I took over one as my little study. I was writing the book, and one day as I was in the middle of the chapter and feeling like things were going well, the Spirit of God was leading, and I was feeling very alive with what I was writing, Rachel came to the bedroom door and said very warmly and very kindly and very appropriately that Jean and Janet, living upstairs, who had a car, we didn't have a car in England, they were going to go to the grocery store, which was some distance away, you couldn't walk to it, we've been walking to all the local butcher markets and meat markets and milk markets and that sort of thing. And she said, we can go to the big grocery store here in England. It's very unusual, huge, bigger than one we've seen in the States, and I thought it might be kind of a fun thing to do together. Do you want to come? Well, her timing was exquisitely wrong. Because right at that moment, man, it was coming good. You know, you're right in the middle of something you really want to do, like a minute and a half to go in the game, that kind of a thing, and your wife wants to go for a walk. Well, that's how it felt to me. But I was working on a chapter that had to do with being a good husband. So I turned to her and said, sure, I'd love to go. Figured if you put your foot in the water will roll back eventually, you know, the Old Testament thing. And if I say what I don't believe, maybe eventually I'll believe it. Sure, I'd love to go. I went and got my coat, and we went downstairs, and how did I feel as I walked into the car? Got into the car to drive to this grocery store. I'll tell you how I felt. Noble. Quite a guy. Boy, you lucked out when you got me, woman. A lot of husbands wouldn't do this. Bet you're grateful. And I presume you're grateful enough that when we get to the grocery store, you'll go through it quickly. So we can get back to what's really important, my calling before God to write this book. You go to the grocery store, and it's, you know, as big a store I ever saw. A couple of Walmarts put together, and this was this grocery store. It's just walking along, have the time of your life. How on earth do you have the time of your life in a grocery store? This is not what I call a tourist attraction. But she's having a great time, and she gets to the spice rack where there's a huge, you know, shelf after shelf of all these bottles with names. Rachel stops, and I'm behind her. I'm pushing the cart, and she stops, and she's looking at the spice rack, and she starts looking at them all. I remember saying to myself, what's she memorizing the names of the spices? So I finally said something. I said, what are you looking for? Ladies, can you all feel the warmth in that? What are you looking for? And she said the name of some spice that I never heard of and could live without. At which point I responded by saying, what do you need that for? At that point, she lost it a little bit. And she turned to me and she said, why did I even ask you to come along at all? You're just messing it up. And she walks down the aisle. Now, how does a noble guy feel when your wife does that? I'm walking behind her. She's walking down the aisle. I got this cart. The thought occurred to me. I deserve better than that. My revenge is justified. Guys, how'd we get so mixed up? I don't deserve revenge. That thought came from wickedness within me. You didn't deserve that from me. Why do I have to do something well? What's going on? Why do I preserve something fragile by backing away from conflict? Why do I demand something deserved, and when I don't get it, do I go to areas that are more reliable? Food, sexual fantasies, you name it. Something's wrong. Do we all agree? Let's take a 10-minute break and come back and figure out what it is. And I want you to see one possible understanding. I don't want to push this understanding, but I want to suggest this understanding. One possible understanding of maybe where the problems began. We all know the problem of sin began here. That's something I'm willing to push because the Bible's clear on it. But I want to say something a little more specific than is normally said, by way of suggestion as to how we as men have developed so many struggles. Why are we so committed to doing something well? Why are we preserving something fragile? Why are we demanding something that we think is deserved? It's not, but we think it is. What's going on inside of us? When something comes up that we're not sure how to handle, we back away. Why is that our pattern? Why did the football star say, when I don't know what to do, I do nothing? Why, when I'm not sure what to do with the woman I'm engaged to, who tells me she's been abused, do I respond internally by saying, I don't know what to do, sounds like too much work, I'm taking a hike. I'm getting out of here quick. And then when married, we still do it, maybe not through divorce, but there's lots of ways to divorce your wife without divorcing your wife. Lots of ways to kill your soul in the process to kill hers and to still have the shell of a marriage. What's at the root of all this? Well, let's take a look at a very familiar passage and see if I can put a twist to it that maybe is in the text. I think it is. And maybe you've seen before, maybe you haven't. Now, the serpent was more crafty. I'll read again the passage that we're very familiar with. Than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say? Now, notice the first thing about this. He comes to the woman who was created after God had spoken to Adam about the prohibition. So when he comes to the woman and says, did God really say, included in that is, did Adam get it right? Because Adam was told, here's the fruit situation, I don't want you to eat this. Of every tree you can have all that you want, but this tree, no, that's totally forbidden. You may not do it. And then Eve is created later, and Adam, no doubt, communicated that to Eve. Honey, God said, and now the serpent comes along and says, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, we may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, as I recall Adam's communication to me, you must not eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die. You will not surely die, the liar said. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. Now, if we believe that this is history and not just a lovely myth or a terrible myth, if we believe it's actually history, that there once was an actual man named Adam, who had we been there, and of course we couldn't have been there, he was the only man, but had we been there, we would have seen a real man and a real woman named Eve. This is real history. This is not fanciful mythology. If we really believe that, we can go back in our mind's eye and visualize what happened, which we can't do very well, of course. How do we normally think about the situation? The serpent came to Eve and talked to her about this fruit of the tree business. As we visualize the situation, where in our minds reflexively was Adam while the serpent tempted Eve? Where was Adam? Isn't it true that somewhat automatically, maybe without thought, that probably a great many people, maybe you, maybe not you, but at least some great number of people, I would suggest, make an automatic assumption that the serpent caught Eve when she was away from Adam all by herself? One commentary I recently read says that specifically, that the serpent found Eve when she was by herself. Is that what the text says? Look at the next phrase. Middle of verse 6. She also gave some to her husband who was with her. Now, if that means what it seems to mean, then I understand that there's more to studying the text than just looking on the surface of it. But for the moment, assume with me that it means what it seems to mean, then I would suggest that what actually happened was this. Here's Eve doing whatever she was doing, and the serpent comes up, and he chose a time when Adam was there. There were times, no doubt, when Adam wasn't there. They weren't together 24 hours a day, and if he wanted to find her when she was by herself off in this corner of the garden, I presume he could have done it. But he comes to her apparently when Adam was there. And he begins talking to her, and Paul tells us, as we noticed earlier in this week, that the serpent deceived her, and Eve was totally deceived, and Adam is there watching the whole thing. Now, if he was there, then I have a real big question. Why didn't he talk? Why didn't he do something? What should he have done? I don't know either. But it occurs to me that whatever he should have done, it was something. I mean, get out a rake and go after that snake. You know, something. Find a shotgun, blast its head off, you know. Grab his wife and say, let's get out of here. Or turn to his wife and say, well, wait a minute, honey. No, you said it wrong there. Let me tell you exactly what God said, because I heard it. And I got a perfect memory. I'm not fallen yet, so my memory is going to be intact here. And I'm going to tell you exactly what he said. You're in the middle of the process of getting deceived. This serpent, I don't know what he's up to, but it's no good somehow. And I'm going to speak, because I'm your advocate. And Adam stood there, just kind of, while the serpent tempts his wife, and his wife falls. And Adam stands there and does nothing. That presumes, of course, that he was there. When that thought first occurred to me, I decided to check with a number of Old Testament scholars, so I called up six of them from across the country.
And one of the Old Testament scholars said that from his study of the text, the data is inconclusive. It could go either way. The other five said that he was there. Now, the one who said he was there that did it most interestingly was a man that Dan called. He and I were in a hotel room together, and we were talking about this, and Dan called a good friend of his who's a leading Old Testament scholar. And I was listening to the phone conversation, and Dan said, "Hey, I want to ask you a question." As they chatted a bit, they're good friends. "I want to ask you a question. Was Adam there when Eve was tempted?" And this scholar said, "No, he wasn't there." And Dan said, "You sure?" "No, he wasn't there." "Well, did you study it?" "I don't know, but I mean, everyone knows he wasn't there." "Do you have textual support for that?" "Well, I haven't studied it." "Well, I want you to study it." The guy paused a minute, Dan paused, and the guy said, "Like, wait, you mean now?" And Dan said, "Yeah, study it now." So the guy went and got his Old Testament and his Hebrew Bible, and he, on the phone, he's kind of muttering in Hebrew away for 6-7 minutes, you know, just kind of, you know, just talking away for a few minutes in Hebrew. And after a few minutes, he shouts into the phone, "That son of a gun was there!" Now, you hear why he says it that way. "That son of a gun..." Because if he was there, why didn't he talk? Let me give you my conjecture. I'm not going to push this because it's conjecture. There's enough hard data in the Bible. We can pin our lives on certain things that are clear. We can't pin our lives on this. But we can suggest this and ponder it together. I don't read any record in the Bible at all. There's no record, obviously, in the Bible where God came to Adam and said, "In about 3 days, here's what's going to happen. The serpent's going to come up to your wife while you're standing there, and he's going to start to try to deceive her, and here's how he's going to do it, and here's what I want you to do in response. Here's exactly the way to handle the temptation of your wife. Do this, do this, do this, do this." We have no record of God ever doing that. Why not? Why didn't God prepare Adam for this? I mean, this is not a minor thing that happened here, to say the least. This is big time. Why wouldn't God go all out? Why wouldn't God go to Adam and say, "Look, I got this enemy, and he's going to come talk to your wife, and here's how to handle it, and if you do it this way, you will have spiritual victory." Why didn't God do that? In the record that he did. My suggestion is, he didn't do it because he respected Adam's masculinity. Let me tell you what I mean by that. There are two ways for men to live, broadly speaking. Either we can live by code, or we can live by courage. Either we can live by code, by a distinctive, well-laid-out, well-delineated code of conduct. Here's what to do when. When you and your wife have a tension, do this. When you find that your son's failing in school, I want you to do this. When you find your daughter is being shamed by her friends at school, I want you to do this. We have a friend that I was with just 2 months ago, and he got a phone call while he was away from his wife and children, and his daughter had been shamed the day before in school in a terrible way. His daughter was a young teenager, and all the girls were developing, and the school teacher made a terrible comment about this teenage girl's lack of visible development. A male teacher in front of the class made a comment. I mean, that's horrendous. And I was with the father within half an hour of his getting the phone call from his wife. And who knows how to handle that? What's the right thing to do?
I-beam.
I-beam. Get an I-beam out. That's right. Yeah. The fact that you enjoyed saying it so much, Reggie. Somebody was saying it during the break. I should have been in the men's room. There was a lineup, and somebody who in the back of the line said, "Oh, for an I-beam." It's a clear out, my turn, you know. You don't know how to handle it, not know how to handle it, so what do most of us do? We don't know how to handle it. We do one of two things. Either we back off or get tough. We get an I-beam and go hit somebody, go yell at somebody, go get a lawyer and sue the guy just out of pure anger. Nothing to do with our daughter's well-being. Either we just kind of take off and beat somebody up, we intimidate, we get strong and think we're macho. We I-beam them to death. We back away and do nothing. In neither case do we speak into the situation for the purpose of bringing life into it. We don't know how to do that. And God doesn't give us a code. Now, when you're in the middle of that situation with your daughter, and you pray about it, and you claim James, who says, if you have no idea what to do, pray for wisdom, do you get up off of your knees having an answer specifically written in the sky? Of course you don't. I heard a prominent Bible teacher say on the radio about 6, 7 months ago, that whenever he has a decision to make, he goes to the Word, and he always comes out with specific direction on exactly what to do. I think that's nonsense. That denies humanity, male or female. And I believe God didn't give Adam any direct code of conduct telling him exactly what to do, because God knew how he built man. He built man not to live by code, if by code you mean specific directions that require no creativity. He rather requires man to pull something out of his depths and to create, not the way God creates out of nothing, but to meaningfully create a response when you haven't got a clue what to do, and you create the response. Why? You're terrified, you're scared, but you still create a response. Why? Because you know how much it matters. You know how important you are to your daughter at that moment. You know how important you are to Eve as the serpent is tempting her. You know how important you are to your son, to your daughter, to your friend, to your church, to your parents, to whomever. You know how important you are, and you care so much because you're consumed with love that you move into the situation and do something even though you don't know what to do. Why is the typical slang phrase to describe a man a wimp? What's a wimp? A wimp is a man who lives by code. A wimp is a man who has no courage. A wimp is a man who doesn't know what to do, does nothing. A wimp is a man who refuses to enter into the situation, and rather than entering into the situation, he looks to solve the situation, and when the situation doesn't get solved, he backs away. Illustration, old-time illustration. Years ago, in my private practice in Boca Raton, Florida, I was counseling with a couple, and they were fairly well-to-do, and they told me about a fight they had the night before that made no sense to the man, and made no sense to me, but I had to think about it, and I think I figured it out some. That as they went to bed that night, and they were reading, and reading in bed, and the woman on her side of the bed, as she was reading, she just said, oh, this spring in the mattress, an old inner spring mattress type thing, this spring is just kicked out of its place, and it's kind of jamming up against my back here, and boy, it's uncomfortable. Now, what should you say, husbands? Same thing with my hair is a mess. Same thing with serpents tempting Eve. Trivial, hugely important, somewhere in between. What do you say? What a man wants to do, typically, because he wants to do something well, where there's no risk, he wants to find some way to redefine the situation so there's a code he can follow. So he reduces what's happening in the woman to a problem he can fix. And what the man said at that point to his wife was, hey, we'll buy a new one tomorrow. And his thought was, his wife would say, oh, thanks. And her response, when he said, we'll buy a new one tomorrow, her response was, I appreciate that, but boy, this hurts. And it's like, well, what'd you say it again for? And he said, honey, what kind do you want? You want a Sealy Posturepedic? Is that the best one? We'll go to Sears and get their best. We'll go to Simmons and get their, what do you want? And she says, oh, that's fine. I'm glad, but boy, this really is getting to my back. Well, what's he asking for? Not a guy in the world has a clue about that. If he lives by code. What does it mean to courageously enter into the mystery of a woman's soul? Even in that little silly type situation. What does it mean to move towards your woman not knowing what's going on, not having a code for how to deal with it, but to somehow get on your horse and like a warrior, go in there to do battle against tension in the relationship, to do battle against loneliness in your wife, to do battle against sorrow, to do battle against things that are wrong, and to somehow do battle against that with the imagination of a poet because you care deeply about your wife. What does it mean? Let me give you my core definition of masculinity. It's the courage to create in chaos. I don't know what to do, and if a man said to me, what am I supposed to do when my wife says the spring is in my back and it's hurting? My response is, I don't know, you don't know, do something. And do something on behalf of your wife because you care about more than merely the spring in her back. You care about that. And certainly the solution is buying a new mattress. That's no problem. For that difficulty, that's the solution. But maybe your wife wants more from you. You know, there's so many men in this world, and probably a fair majority in this room, who have never deeply connected with anybody. We connect at the level of swapping Michael Jordan stories. Or if we're in seminary, we connect at the level of discussing controversial passages. At what level do you connect with your wife, with your friends, with your kids, with your buddies? What does it mean to connect in a way, now forgive me if I sound crude, what does it mean to connect in a way that parallels sexual intercourse? To connect in a way where you're entering another person's life with strength and you're pouring something into them, which if the timing is right, and it may not be, that's not your responsibility. If the egg is available, and that's not your responsibility, you don't control it all. But if other factors are in place, you've done what is capable of passing on life with courage and imagination. If I live by code, I'm never going to do that. Why? Because the most important parts of life have no code. The unimportant parts of life, or put it this way, the less important parts of life, do have a code. There's a proper way for a dentist to fill a tooth, I presume. There's artistry involved in creativity, but there's certain procedures, and you're trained in that if you've been to dental school. There's a certain way for a CPA to balance the budget and to do whatever CPAs do with numbers and computers and calculators. There are certain things to do, and most men are comfortable where there's a code, and they're terrified where there's no code, where courage is required. The most important parts of life have no code. What's the most important part of life? Answer is real simple. Relationship. Go to the Bible and reduce hermeneutics to scholasticism, and the Bible is no longer a vehicle for providing relationship. Reduce exegesis to a linear code, and you lose God. And you gain knowledge, and you're puffed up. I believe Adam failed the test of masculinity. Someone has asked me, as I've taught that material to a different audience, someone has said, well, if Adam didn't speak when Eve was being tempted, wasn't that sin? And doesn't that mean that sin occurred before he took a bite? And I would suggest that sin must always be viewed as a process. The man who ends up in the motel room with a woman who's not his wife and has sex with her, he has sinned when he's had sex with her. But there was a whole process before that led to it. There was the noticing her in the choir on Sunday morning and looking at his wife next to him and being rather angry with her. And then during the sermon, as the choir remains in the choir loft, keeping his eyes on her, lust, when it conceives, brings forth sin. And I wonder if the process of sin began, culminating in the eating of the fruit, when it was clearly visible, now we've come to the point where there's no turning back. Now we got big problems in our hands. God had to reveal his heart through his son on the cross. I suggest that there's a disease that inhabits every man. A disease that requires me, a disease where I feel required to move only when there's a code. I don't want to move where there's chaos. Therefore, I stay away from the most important parts of life, which are relationships. And listen to what you're asking for. Because of the energy within you that you know is committed at least in part, certainly corrupted, motivations always stained, but at least in part, you know you have moved towards your wife, you've moved toward your child, you've moved toward whomever, Now, what does that father do who sat with me at breakfast, with me and Dan at breakfast, and talked about his son who had spent time in jail? And I said to him this question. I said, how do you move toward your son knowing you're doing the right thing? And he basically said, you must live with uncertainty. And that's what you and I, Mike, don't want to do. Can't stand the uncertainty. I want a measuring stick. I want a yardstick. That's what you're asking for. I wish I had one to give you. I think the only measuring stick is, are you walking with the Lord? You define that. And that means a whole lot more than, are you not having affairs? Are you not reading Playboy? All those obvious things. If you're doing that, you're not walking with the Lord. But you can be not doing all that and still not walking with the Lord. And the only way I would suggest you move toward some understanding of whether your passions are right is to explore your style of relating on the basis of feedback. That's the closest I can come to some kind of measurement, but you must not demand it, because as soon as you demand it, you're looking to somehow justify yourself as opposed to really moving into somebody else's life. Got two more topics I want to talk about before our time ends. I have no idea what I said. Yeah, that I may think that I'm doing very well with someone, that I'm being a very good friend. I think it's terribly important. I say to my wife, I say to my friends, I say to whomever, what's it like having me for a friend? Give me feedback on my style of relating. Do you experience my energy moving toward you? If that's a crazy sounding phrase, do you feel like I care about you? Do you feel like you can tell me anything? Do you feel that I'm there present for you on your behalf? That kind of thing. Ask for feedback. Get some understanding as to whether you're moving toward people with an energy that reflects the energy of Christ. One more question and we'll move on. I would suggest that it is very possible that what feels like courage during the day is something other than what I want to define as courage. I think I know what you mean. I relate as a fellow man that during the day I feel like a lot of courage is required of me and I'm just tired of giving. But it seems to me that when you're giving with the courage I'm speaking of, it really is kind of like the oil that never fails. It gets replenished as you do it. There's a time for a break and all that. I understand the need for personal revival and taking a nap and getting a vacation. But I think that what most of us call courage during the day is a frustrated effort to find some code by which to measure ourselves. It really isn't the courage to take whoever we are and to move into our worlds. This should be a small group. We could ask questions for a couple hours, couldn't we? I'm going to talk, so y'all just hush and I'm going to teach a little more. You know, one of the things we really want to do in our men's work is we'd like to provide opportunities after large groups like this to have small group interactions, because that's where I think some real headway would be made. Large groups have their place, but they also have some very definite limits, as those who are wanting to dialogue are indicating, and I appreciate that very much. Let me suggest that if there is this virus that's in me, this virus which doesn't understand the requirement of courage very well, if there is this virus within me which doesn't understand that what it really means to be a man is when I feel paralyzed, when I feel immobilized, when I haven't got a clue what to do, that becomes my opportunity. That becomes my opportunity to pull out of myself what manhood really is. It's parallel to the wilderness outbound adventures, where you take somebody and dump them in the wilderness and say, see you in a week if you survive, good luck. And they have to pull something out of themselves that they did not know was there. You know what I find the older I get? A lot of things, but one thing I find the older I get is that I'm required to pull stuff out of me I never thought was there. There are times I feel so frantic. There are times I don't think I can handle one more microphone or one more audience. There's times the idea of one more conflict with my wife, one more piece of bad news in my family, one more struggle about something or other, and I'm going to capsize. And the fact is, without God, I would, but I have God. God has put within me something called a male identity. And it's possible for me, in the middle of that, to move with courage to create. It's possible for a woman, in the middle of those exact same moments, to find the courage to go out and nourish. And to continue on. Both male and female requiring courage and equal strength, of course. Different expressions, I suggest. As you and I move into our worlds with this basic question that every man is born with, a basic question in their souls, Do I really have what it takes? Maybe I better find a code by which to live. I better figure out my universe as self times world interacts. I've got to crack the code. There is a code by which I can live. If school teachers pull me out of second grade boys' bathrooms with my pants down and I feel real bad, I will define death as feeling like that. And then I will find a code by which I can avoid that experience of death. And maybe the code is something like, never, ever, ever get rowdy again in a way where some woman might get mad at you. There's the code. And the man then follows a nice pattern of being very docile, very friendly, very sweet, never doing anything wrong. And the woman just gets furious at him and gets so mad at him, just wanting to get a rise at him and throw something at him just to hear him say, ouch. Anything. Just to get a rise at him. What's your code? All of us are tempted to live by a code. We've all found one that we think is working. And that code is in place. Why? Because we're not sure if we really have the right stuff. That's built into us as part of the legacy of Adam's failure. My last two topics are these. That struggle that all of us have as men is a struggle that has been accentuated in each of our lives by our fathers. No matter how good a father you may have, and I have one of the best, no matter how good a father you may have, and you may have one of the worst, the struggle has been accentuated because none of you has a perfect father, neither do I. I want to suggest that if you and I are going to develop the kind of masculinity that we need to have to move into our worlds, we can't go back and recreate fatherhood and brotherhood that's been deficient, but we need to enter into the failure of both fatherhood and brotherhood in ways that I want to discuss with you now. Let me tell you what I think a father is. I'll tell it to you in a generic way and then give you my details for it. I'll tell you what a brother is generically, then give you my details. A father, maybe your biological father, or maybe just an older person. A father is a man who believes in you no matter what. A father is a man who believes in you no matter what. A brother is a man with whom you have no secrets. A father is a man that believes in you no matter what. And a brother is a man with whom you have no secrets. Let me describe a father and brother in more detail and see if, as some of you guys sit here, you can enter into what it means to have not been fathered very well. None of us perfectly. Some of us well, but not perfectly. Many of you very badly. And probably very few men in this room have a brother. I'm not speaking about a blood brother. I have a brother. He's with the Lord. Some of you are single children, but that doesn't change the point. How many of you have a man with whom you're intimate in an appropriate David Jonathan kind of a way? Let me define a father for you. Three elements to a father, one who believes in you. Element number one, a man who's ahead of you on the path by 30 years. Whatever number of years, I pick 30. But he's ahead of you on the path. It's a path you want to walk. And you respect the way he's walking it. That's element one. He's ahead of you on the path. It's a path you want to walk. And you respect the way he's walking it. Now ponder quietly as I teach this. Do more than take notes. Think real hard. What person's face comes to mind? Is it your dad? A Sunday school teacher? An elder in your church? An older neighbor? Somebody that you watch him live, and he's ahead of you in the path by 30 years, and it's a path you want to walk. You like the way he handles himself when disappointment comes. You like the way he handles little frustrations when the furnace breaks down in a cold winter day. You like the way he handles his wife. You like the way he handles his kids. And you look at him and you go, huh, that's what I want to be like 30 years from now. I want to walk that path the way he's walking it. Element number one, that's a father. Element number two, as he's walking ahead of you in the path, facing away from you,
it, but I was told the father of this runner left the stands and came out to the track and put his arms around his boy and his boy his arms around his dad, and together they hobbled to the finish line. I think that's wonderful. But I'll tell you this, fathers. Good fathers never help their children in a way that doesn't require them to give all that they have. When giving all that they have really doesn't do the job, and the leg is broken, nothing's wrong with dad coming out and helping across finish line. But most good fathers come out to the track too soon. Why do I say that? The good father is one who's on the path ahead. You like the way he's walking it. It's a path you want. You like the way he treats his wife. You like how his life is going, not in terms of material success and all that. That may or may not be there. That's irrelevant. You see his character, the way he handles life, the way he honestly faces the realities of life, and he struggles with it and he hurts with it, but he's making it, and you admire him. He turns around, element two. He looks at you 30 years back on the path. You know he cares. He understands. And as he looks at you, he's talked with you, he's made known his life, and you think he's going to kind of run back and help you. He looks at you, and then without a smile, he turns around and he keeps... But I was told the father of this runner left the stands and came out to the track and put his arms around his boy and his boy his arms around his dad, and together they hobbled to the finish line. I think that's wonderful. But I'll tell you this, fathers. Good fathers never help their children in a way that doesn't require them to give all that they have. When giving all that they have really doesn't do the job, and the leg is broken, nothing's wrong with dad coming out and helping across finish line. But most good fathers come out to the track too soon. Why do I say that? The good father is one who's on the path ahead. You like the way he's walking it. It's a path you want. You like the way he treats his wife. You like how his life is going, not in terms of material success and all that. That may or may not be there. That's irrelevant. You see his character, the way he handles life, the way he honestly faces the realities of life, and he struggles with it and he hurts with it, but he's making it, and you admire him. He turns around, element two. He looks at you 30 years back on the path. You know he cares. He understands. And as he looks at you, he's talked with you. He's made known his life. And you think he's going to kind of run back and help you. He looks at you. And then without a smile, he turns around and he keeps walking to something more important than you. Do your kids a favor. Have something more important than them in your life. So if they fall apart, you can make it. Dads. And by turning around and walking, what you're saying is not only, there's something more important to me than you, you're very important to me, but there's something more important. There's God. Not only is he saying that, but he's also saying this. I really believe in you. You might go through hell and back. You might struggle in ways that are unbelievable in your marriage, in your job, in your situation. Because I can remember it was hard for me too. I made it by the power of God, and you can make it by the power of God. See you later. A good father doesn't help very often. You know, one of the best pictures of that in film history is the movie Bambi. I saw it for the first time about 4 or 5 months ago. I'd been deprived all my life. I didn't know until 4 or 5 months ago that Bambi was a boy. Can you imagine naming your kid Bambi? I mean, this should have been Bambo. Yeah. They call this boy Bambi. Bambi's mother is dead. Bambi's in the middle of the forest. It's on fire. Fire's circling. Bambi's fallen down, sprained legs, can't get up. And the father deer appears. And father looks into the clearing where Bambi's lying about to be burned. And what does the father do? He doesn't come in and pick Bambi up. What father says is, "Get up, Bambi." And father turns around and walks away saying, "If you will, you can follow." And Bambi struggles to get to his feet and makes it until the day that he becomes a father. Little children, young men, fathers. Three elements to a father. Gentlemen, we have about 150 of you in the room. If you have a father the way I've just described one, if you have a man in your life, you watch the way he walks and you respect it so deeply, you want to be like him. He's turned around and he's seen you in a way that you feel like you're the only person in the world. He's seen you. He knows what it's like. And he believes in you so much that he turns around and keeps on walking. If you have a man in your life that's a father, raise your hand. Look around, gentlemen. 4 or 5 hands are up. Ladies, your guys have a hard time. They have nobody who believes in them, most of them. And it's tough. A brother is just as rare. It's one who's walking the path with you, element one. It's one who's walking the path with you. A brother is a man who's walking the path with you. He likes being on that same path with you. It's a good path. You're having fellowship. You're in the same boat. And you each have an oar, and you're rowing together in the same direction, the same boat, it's the same path. That's what the word fellowship means in the New Testament. Element one, you're walking the same path. You both want to be on that path. Element two, as you're walking the path together, you turn toward each other, and you share your secrets. You share what makes it so hard to walk the path. You talk about, you know, I can't believe it, but I have lost interest in my wife, and some other woman just draws me so much, and I'm scared. Who do you tell that to? A good friend of mine about 3 years ago was a counselor, and he said to me, "I've got a counselee, and I'm scared to death. Every time she comes in, all I do is lust the whole hour. I like her so much better than my wife." A lot of men have something like that. Who do you tell it to? Don't raise your hand for this. How many of you have a secret that you've never told anybody? If there's 150 men in the room, and if you were honest, about 120 hands would go up. Something in your life that you are conspicuously omitting from your deepest conversation with your best friend. It is too embarrassed. It's hard. I know something about that. It's very difficult. Very important to have a brother who knows you. A brother is one who looks at you as you walk the path together. You look into each other's eyes and you share your secrets. One is not above the other. You're co-strugglers. The third element is real obvious. You're ahead of me. You help each other. You know what's as important to me as anything? As I think about fathering and brothering, I need to realize as a father there's some things I just can't do. And I've got to pray, "God, give my boys a brother." Don't try to be a brother to your sons. Can't do it. And brothers, don't try to be the role of a father. Don't try to play some hotshot old man. You can't do it. Fathers do what fathers do. Brothers do what brothers do. How wonderful if in the body of Christ, if we as men could move toward one another as brothers, if we could move toward younger men as fathers, do you realize that it's time to get our minds off of ourselves and rather than focusing on how badly we've been unfathered and how badly we've been unbrothered, we could all father somebody? Every 20-year-old person in the room could father some 10-year-old kid, by my definition of fathering. Every man in the room could brother somebody. How? Well, I haven't got a code. chaotic, isn't it? Where's your courage? Go create. I don't know how to do it either. Last thing I want to say is this. I come into this world with Adam's virus, and no one's fathered entirely well. Some are fathered fairly well. Some are fathered miserably. 5 or 6 hands went up who described themselves as having a father. And something inside of me says, what I feared, I can't handle life. I need a code. What I feared is true. Nobody believes in me. And I'm going through stuff that's so weird you wouldn't believe it. And I can't tell anybody. I'll make it. No, you won't make it. You'll look like you're making it. For a while, your wife isn't fooled. Your kids aren't fooled. You're not making it. You're not enjoying the Lord. So what do you do? A simple sentence. This is the last thought of the day, the afternoon. Once again, it all comes back to Christ. How does it come back to Christ? We look at Jesus, and He reveals the Father. He reveals the Father how? As He walks the path ahead of us, the Son reveals the Father to me. Jesus reveals the Father as He walks the path, and I say, I want to live like Him. And He turns around as my great high priest, and He looks at me, and He says, I know what you're going through. I've been there. Then He walks on and says, follow me. Jesus reveals the Father. And Jesus sends the Paraclete, the Spirit, who walks with us on the path, who prompts us to reveal our inmost secrets, who says nothing is hid, and when you pray, I'll supply the words when you can't even put it into words. And I'll prompt you, strengthen you, quicken you in the inner man. I'll give you what you need. If we're going to get started in all this, maybe the thing to do is to admit the fears within us, admit how scared we are to live without a code. Maybe it's time to embrace the loss of never having had a father or a brother. Maybe it's time to find somebody to whom we can tell our story and all of its secrets. Maybe it's time to release the warrior within us and do something. Don't be quiet when your wife is tempted by the devil. Speak into the darkness. Bring life as a warrior. You'll foul it up. Just keep on going. And nourish the poet. Enter the world of depth. Don't be afraid of deep, hard conversations. Let your imagination run. Read good novels. Go to good films and think. Skip the John Wayne movie. And maybe go see a Woody Allen movie. And ponder. And wonder. Read the Bible, not just to have your daily devotions, but read the Bible and think, what was it like for David to face Goliath? Huh. Let me ponder. Nourish the poet within you. And if Jesus reveals the Father, and if Jesus sends His Spirit, then you and I have all we need to move into this world with the courage of manhood. Father, again, we pray that You'll accomplish Your purpose, whatever they are. Some of the men who are a little more aware of what's lost in their lives, they never want to be a cowboy again. Father, teach them to put back on the holster. And Father, for those who've been dragged out into the room with their pants down, teach them that they can pull their pants up and move. Father, make some women happy today because of what men do. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.